My name is Ryan Parker. I've always been fascinated by those shared childhood experiences nobody ever recalls until someone brings it up in a conversation. Then, everyone suddenly remembers, like how we all used to step on certain colored tiles in the hallway, or how we'd all hold our breath when passing graveyards. Last month, I was at a dinner party with my fiance and some of her friends. Someone mentioned those S-shaped symbols everyone drew in middle school, and the whole table erupted in recognition. People from different states, different decades, all drawing the same exact thing. Or those paper fortune tellers we'd all fold, all with the same design, same rules. Who taught us that? Nobody remembers learning it, just knowing it. At some point, I brought up the stairs thing. You know what I'm talking about. That instinctual panic when you're walking up a staircase and suddenly you're absolutely certain that something is behind you, reaching for your ankles. Her friends nodded and laughed about how they'd sprint up the staircase to escape whatever entity was surely gaining on them. For each of them, it was just childhood imagination and something that made them get where they were going just a little bit faster. For me, it was the beginning of everything wrong in my life. It was at Tommy's 13th birthday party at his folks' house in Norwalk. We were all kids from the neighborhood. Me, Kevin, Zach, Marcus, Hannah, Tori. I can't remember everyone else. Hannah would all these years later become my fiance, though back then, she was just the girl who lived next door to Tommy. Tori was at the dinner party that night too, along with Marcus. I had not seen either of them in over 12 years. Back in Connecticut, houses like Tommy's always had those finished basements, wood-paneled walls, drop ceilings, and that weird halfway underground smell. Tommy's parents had set it up with an old sectional couch, some beanbag chairs, and a TV with a GameCube hooked up to it. We huddled around the screen that night playing Mario Kart. We always played where the person who finished last had to do something stupid like get hit in the back with a wiffle ball. Tori, Hannah, and the rest of the girls half watched from the beanbags, more interested in their own conversations. Despite the high stakes of the game, I found my attention occasionally drifting to the group of girls. Something about Tori had always made me uneasy. I never connected with her when we were kids. Hannah and the others didn't seem to notice, but there was something off about her, especially that night. Her disheveled black hair looked like I hadn't seen a brush in weeks, and her abnormally large eyes seemed to absorb everything around her. Sometimes, I'd look up from the screen and catch her staring at me, not smiling or frowning, just watching me. Hannah and the other girls treated her like any other friend. During summer pool parties, Tori would never join us in the water. She'd sit under the shade of an umbrella in her regular clothes, claiming she couldn't get wet. Hannah was always too kind to leave her alone, sitting beside her while the rest of us splashed around in the pool. Despite Tori's oddness, the neighborhood and even Tommy's basement that night were spacious enough that I could keep my distance. The party flowed naturally, as these things do. I was even lucky enough to have Marcus completely miss when he had the chance to hit me with the wiffle ball. We'd all been fueling our gaming marathon with cherry cokes, and after my third can, nature called. Tommy's basement had all the comforts except a bathroom. The only option was to head up the stairs to the main floor. I remember reaching the bottom of the staircase, looking up at the narrow passage with its beige carpet runner. Like most basement stairs, they were steeper than normal house stairs, and closed on both sides by walls. One bare bulb lit the way from the top. As I mentioned before, every kid knows that feeling on the basement stairs. I'd always felt it, that skin-crawling sensation between my shoulder blades, the urge to sprint up the steps without looking back. Until that night, I'd never actually stopped on the stairs, never turned around. It was an unwritten rule in my head. As long as you don't look back, everything will be fine. I was about halfway up when I heard Hannah call out my name. I don't know why I stopped. Maybe it was the sugar rush from the Coke, or the excitement of the party. I simply wasn't thinking at the time, but I actually stopped and turned around to call out to her. There she was, not Hannah, not any of my friends. A disfigured woman crouched just 3 steps below me. Her skin was gray like ancient parchment stretched over bone. Her face was distorted, features arranged all wrong, as if they'd been placed by someone who'd only heard descriptions of a human face. Her eyes were impossibly large, white pools that reflected nothing. Long, matted black hair hung in filthy strands around her face. She balanced on all fours in an aggressive position, fingers splayed like spider legs against the carpet. I couldn't move, couldn't breathe. Then something snapped inside me. I scrambled, falling upward as I tore through the remaining stairs and burst through the door, stumbling to Tommy's kitchen. My palms stung from where I caught myself on the floor, but I barely noticed the pain. All I could think about was putting distance between myself and whatever was on those stairs. Tommy's dad was at the counter baking coffee. He turned toward me, startled by my sudden entrance, and asked me what was going on. I couldn't answer, couldn't even look at him. My eyes were fixed on the basement door, waiting for it to swing open. I backed away slowly, then spun and bolted through the back door into the night air. I ran across Tommy's lawn, through the neighbor's yard, and around the corner to my house in a dead sprint, never once looking back. It took 2 years of therapy before I could even approach a staircase again. 2 years of careful work with Dr. Westfield, who specialized in childhood trauma. For the longest time, I refused to explain what happened that night on the staircase to anyone but Dr. Westfield. Not the full truth, anyway. My parents knew pieces of it. They had to, given my sudden inability to climb, descend, or even look at stairs. But I never told them everything. For my friends, I manufacture the simple lie. Severe vertigo from an inner ear infection. It explained the homeschooling, the refusal to visit their multi-level homes, the way I'd freeze at the top of any incline. They accepted it with the casual disinterest of teenagers. That sucks, was the extent of their sympathy, which suited me fine. Hannah was the only one who came to check on me in those terrible first weeks. She'd sit quietly in my room, sometimes for hours, ever pressing for details. She seemed to know something about what had happened that night on those stairs, occasionally nodding knowingly when I talked about the edges of my experience. I assumed my parents had filled her in on some of the sanitized version of the events I told them. I still remember sitting in Dr. Westfield's dimly lit office, session after session. He primarily focused on my absolute certainty that a thing I saw on the staircase was Tori, or some version of her. His notepad would fill with the small, careful script as it described the similarities of their eyes and hair. But when he pressed for more details, I found myself struggling. There was little else connecting the thing on the staircase to our neighbor beyond those surface features. Dr. Westfield would always nod thoughtfully, tapping his pen against his legal pad. His theory that my discomfort around the real Tori, her unsettling stare, the way she'd appear almost predatory at the party, had somehow projected onto this hallucination. The woman on the stairs represented my unease made manifest. More concerning to him was my physical state. I'd been down with the flu for a week before Tommy's birthday, barely eating, mostly sleeping and drinking Gatorade. That night at the party, I loaded up on caffeine from all the available soda. Dr. Westfield explained how this combination, malnourishment, dehydration, and stimulants could easily produce visual disturbances. After 2 years, stairs finally just became stairs again. Dr. Westfield's methodical approach has slowly dismantled my terror, reducing the thing I'd seen from a lurking horror to what he called a manifestation that accumulated stress. I believed him because I needed to, and because the alternative was unthinkable. When Dr. Westfield announced his 6-month sabbatical, I was surprised by my own disappointment. Our sessions had become a comfort and a regular reassurance that what I had experienced wasn't real. But despite this, I spent most of those 6 months operating as a normal teenager again. I even hung out in Tommy's house, although I was not brave enough to venture to the basement. Upon Dr. Westfield's return, I scheduled an appointment, or out of courtesy than necessity. I had been doing well, climbing stairs without my heart racing, and sleeping without nightmares. When I entered Dr. Westfield's office that afternoon, everything fell off. His usual composed, reassuring presence had been shifted into something like subdued anxiety. He regarded me with uneasy eyes, leaning forward in his chair, suggesting cautious curiosity. Something in him had changed, as if his sabbatical left behind traces I couldn't understand. Disturbingly, his questions were no longer aimed at dismissing the thing I saw as mere imagery, born of fatigue or fear. Instead, he gently prodded for details I may have forgotten, any small gesture, thought, or act I'd done back then that could have angered or provoked it. Leaving his office that day, I was absolutely sure that I wouldn't be coming back. I was cured. Life eventually moved on. I graduated high school, went to college, reconnected with Hannah, and eventually we got engaged. The stairs incident and Tori had become distant memories, things I rarely thought about. At the dinner party that night, I told this story. Not the entire story, mind you, just the watered-down version that felt safe enough to share. I left out the description of the figure on the staircase, Dr. Westfield, and anything regarding my suspicion of Tori. Hannah shot me this curious, surprised look from across the table, like she couldn't quite believe I'd chosen tonight of all nights to finally open up about it. As I spoke, I glanced at Tori, trying not to be obvious. I watched her carefully, searching for some sort of subtle change, anything, but her face remained relaxed, revealing nothing. You're probably wondering right now, if I'm really as cured as I said I am, what would compel me to bring up a story like this? It's because it happened again. After years of saving, Hannah and I had finally purchased the modest 2-story colonial in Greenwich. The real selling point was the finished basement, a comfortable entertainment space for hosting friends. The neighborhood was similar to the one we grew up in, not one of those uber-rich neighborhoods everyone associates with the portion of Connecticut bordering New York, but a very New England-style middle-class neighborhood. I almost choked down my beer the night Hannah casually mentioned that Tori lived in our neighborhood now. We had been unpacking boxes in the kitchen when she dropped this revelation that Tori Henderson lived just 3 streets over. Hannah seemed unfazed, explaining that Tori had changed considerably since our teenage years. Apparently, she'd transformed from the intense, unsettling girl I remembered into a respectable finance professional who commuted daily to Manhattan. I nodded along, but couldn't shake the uneasy feeling settling into my stomach as I recalled her piercing stare from Tommy's basement that night. I felt angry and upset that Hannah had not mentioned this before we had moved in. I wanted to say something to her, but I had to let the words die in my throat as I realized I had no rational explanation for my reaction. What would I say? That her odd behavior as a kid still bothered me over a decade later, that I suspected our childhood friend of being the disfigured woman who tried to grab me on the stairs that night. Despite my lingering unease about Tori's proximity, I never brought it up again. Eventually, Hannah and I fell into a comfortable routine. We'd both commute into New York each day for work. She to her insurance firm, me to my marketing agency. The train ride was about 45 minutes each way, which gave us time to read or catch up on emails. We'd usually try to coordinate our schedules to ride home together at least a few days a week. When we got home in the evenings, we found ourselves spending most of our time in the basement. Hannah especially liked it down there, far more than our living room. It was fully furnished, wall-to-wall beige carpeting, recessed lighting that kept every corner well lit, and a large flat screen mounted against the far wall. By July, we'd picked a date and the discussions gradually consumed all of our evenings. One night in particular, Hannah and I sat downstairs, flipping through invitation samples spread across the basement coffee table. The disagreement began gently, as they often do. It was a question about numbers. I wanted something smaller, more manageable, while Hannah seemed hell-bent on inviting practically everyone she'd crossed paths with. Name after name spilled from her lips, acquaintances from college who barely qualified as Facebook friends, distant family friends obscured by time, even Tori's name emerged. It seemed ridiculous, this need Hannah felt to include people who hadn't been around for ages. She'd barely spoken to Tori over these past years. She told me they exchanged the occasional Facebook message, but nothing beyond that. I tried to explain just how absurd it felt to send an invitation to someone so distant from our lives. The argument continued for several more minutes, with Hannah refusing to yield on any of the names. I could see she was getting frustrated, her cheeks flushed as she insisted we needed just more time to make these decisions. Before I could press further, my phone buzzed in my pocket, offering a welcome escape. The caller ID showed my office number. "I need to take this," I said as I rose from my section of the couch. I answered as I walked towards the staircase, hearing my supervisor's voice explaining something about quarterly projections that needed immediate attention. The steps creaked beneath my weight as I climbed, seeking the privacy of our upstairs office. Halfway up the stairs, I heard Hannah call my name from below. I turned, my hand still gripping the railing. She wasn't there. Instead, crouched four steps below me was the same disfigured woman from my childhood. Her paper-gray skin stretched tight across her misshapen skull. Those impossibly large eyes stared up at me without blinking. Her black, matted hair still hung in greasy strands around her distorted face. She was farther away this time, at least four or five steps below me, but again she appeared to be in an aggressive position, like a mountain lion waiting to pounce. I was far enough up the stairs so that I couldn't see Hannah on the couch anymore. The wall separating the staircase from the basement living area blocked my view of her. I wanted to call out, but my voice failed me. My lips parted, but no sound emerged. Just a dry, silent gasp as I stared at the thing crouched below me. My supervisor's voice continued in my ear, but the words registered as distant noise. All I could focus on was the woman's face. She didn't move, and neither did I. We existed in this suspended moment of mutual observation, like predator and prey assessing one another. My heart slammed painfully against my ribs. Then, without conscious decision, I turned and bolted up the remaining stairs, taking them two at a time in a frantic scramble. My shoulders slammed into the wall at the landing. When I reached the top, I spun around, back pressed against the hallway wall, ready to defend myself. The staircase was empty. From my position, I could just barely see the edge of Hannah's feet, propped up on the coffee table in the basement below. I wanted to shout a warning to Hannah, to tell her she wasn't safe down there, that something terrible was lurking on those stairs, but some primal instinct silenced me. My voice refused to work. It felt something like self-preservation. In the moment, it seemed like if I made any sound that figure might appear again on the staircase. I quickly retreated to our garage. The wide garage door was open, letting in the cool night air that smelled like cut grass and asphalt. Our two cars were still parked in the driveway because the garage itself remained full with moving boxes we hadn't gotten around to unpacking yet. The thought made me dizzy. If what I saw was real, then my wife was never going to be the same again. My phone buzzed in my pocket. It was a text message from Hannah. "Can you bring a glass of water down when you come back?" I stared at the message. What could I possibly tell her? What explanation could I give that wouldn't make me sound like a completely unhinged lunatic? And more pressing, how could I go back into the house, knowing what might be waiting for me on the stairs? I couldn't bring myself to go back inside. My phone buzzed again. This time, Hannah was calling me. I pulled it out and stared at her name on the screen. I let it go to voicemail. A few minutes later, she called again. I let it ring until it stopped. Why wasn't she just coming upstairs? Eventually, I couldn't take it anymore. The dread of going back inside was overwhelming. I walked into my car and got in. I drove away, heading towards my office in New York. While I was driving, a sudden panic hit me. What if Hannah had been calling me to tell me she saw something? 20 minutes into the drive, I finally called her back. The way she answered told me she had not seen anything. I fabricated a story about an emergency system failure at work that required my immediate attention, something I could only fix in person. I spent the entire night at my empty office, staring at my computer screen, but only seeing that thing on our stairs. By morning, I was no closer to understanding what had happened to me or what I should do next. I did return home the next day after work, slipping in through the front door with an artificial casualness that felt painfully obvious. For the next several days, I developed a careful strategy of abasement avoidance. I'd suddenly remember urgent emails that needed sending from our office upstairs whenever Hannah suggested watching a movie downstairs. Each night, I'd retreat to our bedroom earlier than usual. A few days later, Hannah and I were shopping at the local Stop and Shop when we turned the corner of an aisle and came face to face with Tori Henderson. I froze mid-step, my hands tightening around the shopping cart handle as Hannah let out a delighted gasp of recognition. The two of them embraced while I stood there, unable to look away from Tori's face. She seemed perfectly normal, well-dressed in a casual business attire. Her hair was neatly styled. My legs tensed with the instinct to bolt from the grocery store right then and there, but I forced myself to remain rooted in place. Hannah launched into a flurry of excited questions, trying to recall the last time they'd seen each other. She guessed about 3 years, maybe a little longer. Tori quickly corrected her, saying it had been at least 8, maybe closer to 9. They had not seen each other since college. Hannah seemed a little caught out by this, but it didn't stop her from inviting Tori to join us for dinner at Marcello's the following weekend. I couldn't find my voice to object. Throughout their conversation, Tori's gaze kept drifting back to me. Not a friendly glance, not an acknowledgement of my presence, but something colder and more assessing. It felt like she was studying me, trying to figure something out. Hannah seemed entirely oblivious to my discomfort. When she finally finished her enthusiastic recap of our wedding plans, we parted ways, but not before Tori said she would join us for dinner the following weekend. As I sat at the dinner table, watching everyone's reaction to my story, I found myself strangely frustrated by Tori's lack of response. While Marcus and Hannah and everyone else had at least shown surprise or concern, Tori had remained utterly impassive, as if hearing about a disfigured woman on my basement stairs was completely normal. I wanted to continue, to add more details that might provoke some reaction from her. I wanted to describe the figure's gray skin stretched over her misshapen bones, the way its eyes never seemed to blink, how it crouched like a predator. But the moment slipped away as Hannah steered the conversation away from my strange story. I sat there, a knot tightening in my stomach, the feeling of losing control washing over me. I wanted to stand up, point at Tori, and accuse her of something. I didn't even know what, of being involved, of knowing something, of being something, but the absurdity of it stopped me. What proof did I have? I excused myself and went to the bathroom. I spent nearly 10 minutes in there, ripping the edges of the sink and staring at my reflection. My face looked drawn and pale. I splashed cold water on my cheeks and tried to steady my breathing. I decided that when they were all getting up to leave, I would say something to Tori, something quiet under my breath, just to try to get her to slip when she wasn't expecting it. Just a few words, a question maybe, something about the basement. When I stepped out of the bathroom, Tori was standing in the narrow corridor alone, clearly waiting for me. Immediately I felt my muscles tense, my heart climbing slowly into my throat. She stood there, unmoving, looking at me with that penetrating gaze that I had grown to dread. She glanced around as though afraid of being overheard. "Ryan, I need to speak to you." She told me about an experience she'd had 3 years earlier, back when she was living alone in Stamford. She described a late evening when she'd turned off the downstairs lights and started climbing up the stairs. Halfway up, she felt a cold prickle at the back of her neck and stopped. When she turned around, she said she saw someone crouch below her, pale and distorted, matching exactly the description I'd mentioned earlier. The incident had been so disturbing that she'd immediately moved to Greenwich, deliberately choosing a ranch-style home with no stairs at all. She said she didn't even take anything from her apartment. She was too scared to return for even her most valuable belongings. I stood in silence, absorbing Tori's story. Every gesture, every expression, I studied them all, searching for some tell, some crack in her performance. Her voice had remained even throughout. Not once did she break eye contact. For a moment, it almost looked like she was going to cry. "Ryan, how do you cope with the mental aspect of seeing..." "It's you," I interrupted, my voice flat and certain. "You are the thing from my stairs." Tori's face shifted. The fear melted away, replaced by something cold. It happened so fast I'd almost doubted I'd seen it. I didn't back down. "I know it's you, Tori. I've always known it was you." She didn't say a word, just turned and walked away, disappearing down the hallway. I stood there for a moment, heart hammering against my ribs, before returning to the table. I sat there replaying Tori's words over and over in my mind, replaying her reaction to my accusation. Had that been a confession? The cold look that had crossed her face haunted me. I kept sneaking glances at her across the table, but she was acting completely normal now, laughing at something Marcus had said. Hannah squeezed my knee under the table, saying something I couldn't quite process. Marcus was gesturing with his wine glass, voices carrying on around me. I nodded occasionally, but I might as well have been underwater. When I finally snapped back to reality, I realized everyone was getting to their feet. The restaurant had emptied out. We were among the last tables remaining. We spilled out into Marcello's parking lot just after 11. The night air carried a damp chill and several of the lot's lights were out, creating pools of darkness around the cars. I positioned myself next to Hannah, keeping her between Tori and I as we exchanged goodbyes. "We should do this again soon," Marcus said, clapping me on the shoulder. Hannah made enthusiastic plans with everyone, while I nodded along, careful to avoid looking in Tori's direction. She seemed equally intent on not acknowledging me, her gaze focused on Hannah or the darkened sky whenever I glanced her way. Marcus and Tori finally pulled away, leaving Hannah and I in the parking lot. I watched the red taillights of Tori's car disappear around the corner. I stewed in my thoughts the entire drive home, barely contributing to the conversation as Hannah chattered on about the evening. I silently debated what I could or should tell Hannah about my suspicion of Tori. The rational part of me knew how this would sound, accusing her childhood friend of being some sort of demonic entity that haunted my staircase. but the weight of keeping this to myself had become unbearable. My confrontation with Tori in the hallway had left me convinced. By the time we pulled into our driveway, I was mentally exhausted. When we got inside, Hannah told me that she was going to do some wedding planning that she'd been putting off. She collected her notebook from the kitchen counter and went down to the basement. I nodded, watching as she disappeared down the staircase. I pulled the whiskey out of the cabinet, looking for a temporary reprieve from my anxiety. I took a deep swig from the bottle when I heard Hannah's distant voice call up from below. "Ryan, I think someone's been down here. The TV's off the wall. There's stuff everywhere. I think someone broke in." My mind immediately conjured an image of Tori somehow getting into our house before we returned. I approached the top of the basement stairs cautiously, taking a few steps down. I couldn't see Hannah, but I could see some of her belongings scattered across the floor at the bottom. The TV that had been mounted on the wall was indeed lying face down on the floor. Books from the shelf had been thrown around, and a lamp lay broken in the corner. A terrible thought took root in my mind. "Hannah, I think you should come upstairs. It might not be safe down there." I paused, gripping the railing. "I think Tori might be down there." After a moment, Hannah appeared near the bottom of the stairs, but I could only see her from the waist down. Her upper half remained obscured by the ceiling that jutted out above the staircase. "Hannah, I need to tell you something. Something happened tonight." My voice shook as I stared down at her partial figure. "I think it was Tori who I saw on the stairs in Tommy's basement. I think she has been here, too." Hannah remained still near the bottom of the staircase. I couldn't see her face to gauge her reaction. The silence stretched between us for far too long. I gripped the railing even tighter, waiting for any response, but she remained completely motionless. "Hannah," I finally called out.
"Ryan, I'm the thing from the staircase. I am the cold between the floorboards. I am the creak in the dark. I am the weight that follows your ankles. Your racing heartbeat is my lullaby. Your hurried steps are my invitation. I have always been there, and I will always be there. In Tommy's basement, in our home, on every staircase you will ever climb. When you feel that prickle between your shoulders, that is my breath. When you hear your name called from below, that is my voice. You were right to run, but there is nowhere to hide. I wait on every landing, behind every door that leads to steps. There will come a night when you feel my cold fingers around your ankle, and when you look back, it will be the last time. I will pull you down, down into the hollow space beneath your stairs.